Welcome to Tales from the Fourth Trimester, a podcast dedicated to the beauty and brutality of new motherhood. I'm your host, Naomi Chrysalakis, and I'm a postpartum doula and cook in Sydney, Australia. My service, Cocoon, provides good food and a helping hand for new mamas. Join me as I chat to women about what happened after they brought their baby home and interview experts for their wisdom. Because giving birth is just the beginning. Hello and welcome to Tales from the Fourth Trimester. Have you ever wondered how the experts in pregnancy do pregnancy and postpartum themselves? Today I've got Renee Jennings on, who is a clinical dietitian who specializes in maternal health and pediatrics, and she is sharing what she did in her first pregnancy and postpartum, the mistake she made, or the things I should say rather than the mistake she made, is the things she learned, and what she's going to be doing second time round. She's pregnant with her second bub at the moment. So this is full of not only Renee's own experiences with pregnancy and postpartum, including breast refusal by her little girl when she was just 9 weeks old and how she dealt with that. But also it's packed with practical tips on everything from how to make the best porridge. We talked about our porridge obsession and how to really utilize your freezer for meal prep. So I'm a real geek about that sort of thing, obviously, and I really enjoyed chatting to Renee, and I hope you guys find it helpful as well. Today, I've got Renee Jennings with me. Hi, Renee. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So can we just start by talking a little bit about you? Can you tell everyone who you are, what you do, where you live, who you live with, all of those good things?
Sure. So, my name's Renee and I live in Wollongong, which I love. It's a very lovely social beach town on the south coast of New South Wales. And I live with my husband and my almost two-year-old daughter, which seems crazy that she's almost two. And I'm a dietitian, and I work part-time at the moment after coming back from my first maternity leave. And I work in pediatrics and maternal health, as well as doing some other stuff on the general wards at the hospital. I really love working in pediatrics. I've done it off and on over the last few years. And I work in a feeding clinic with children mostly aged kind of 0 to 5, and with a speech pathologist as well. So I really, really, I really love my job as a clinical dietitian. But I also love my days where I get to spend with my daughter as well.
It's like a great combo.
Yeah, it is a really, really lovely combo. As I said before, Wollongong's a really lovely social town. So we spend a lot of time with our friends, our family. And probably one of the biggest things about me is I love to cook, as most of my friends know, or really just anything to do with food. Very much grew up in a food-obsessed family. My mum's Italian, if that helps.
says it all, really.
But my father's a really great cook as well, and it seems to have spread through all my siblings. So, anything to do with food, probably hence why I'm a dietitian, is something that I enjoy as well.
It's funny, though. I think people who grow up around food and seeing it being made and, seeing that real love and respect for food, you kind of can't help but grow up and have a bit of a different perspective. I don't know. I've my grandma would always cook and cook with me, and my mum cooked with me a lot. And my mum was English, like doesn't come from a particularly rich culinary heritage, English, Irish, the cabbage and the potatoes aren't, but she loved to cook and she would try and, she'd make curries and so I've kind of got a similar sort of
Yeah, I think how you said the like love for food, and that I think that's it. Like a lot of people view food as just something that they need for sustenance, whereas in my family, it's very much like a love and a passion, and it's a lot more than what you use to fill your belly. So, I could clearly talk about food all day.
Well, that's what we need to do, really. Tell me a little bit about the work that you do. So, in maternal health, is that mostly with pregnant women or postpartum? Like, what sort of women are you working with?
As a clinical dietitian, I don't do a lot with maternal women. I see a few women on the ward when they're admitted, which is mostly for hyperemesis. So, which I feel so sorry for them. So in that situation, you know, I'm only usually seeing them on the one off, which is a bit unfortunate, but that's just the way the hospital works. And unfortunately we don't have funding for clinics for maternal, health, but outside of my clinical dietetics, as I can talk a little bit about a bit later, but I do work with women doing, helping them educate them in regards to nutrition for pregnant women.
Yeah.
Which I'm passionate about.
We will definitely get to that. And you are pregnant yourself.
I am. So yeah, I'm currently 17 weeks pregnant with my second. So yeah, very, very excited. And I think it's come with good timing with everything I'm doing for work, since I feel like I can really practice what I preach at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to pre-baby land, if you can remember. Tell me a little bit about before you had your daughter, what your expectations of parenthood were. What did you always want to have kids?
I did. I guess like my family was very, we had a very family orientated upbringing, and I always knew I couldn't wait to be a mum, even though I wasn't in a rush to do it, if that makes any sense. And I think I was really lucky in a sense that I had a very real expectation of motherhood. My sister, who I'm very close with, she already had two children, and she was pregnant with her third when I was pregnant with my first.
Mm-hmm.
So that was awesome. And my sister-in-law, who I'm also extremely close with, she had two children. So we spent so much time with our nieces and nephews, and because I have very good relationships with both sisters, who are both called Allison, which is quite funny, mm-hmm. I really knew like the ins, and I felt like I had a really good understanding of the ins and outs of parenting, not just the you know, the glimmer that you see on Instagram or something like that. And I think what also helped is I had a lot of very close friends who were either pregnant or had just had a child. And they went through those really gruesome details of, you know, the extra large undies that you need to wear and all of the interesting stuff about birth. So, I guess I was really excited. However, I really knew it was going to be challenging. So I kind of had this, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but I really had this expectation that, I was going to be sleep deprived, and if I got an 2 hours sleep in a row, that was going to be a bonus. And I knew the difficulties of breastfeeding, and that it was going to be a bit of an emotional roller coaster. So I kind of felt like, I don't know, but I guess at the same time, I still had this ideal of like, this is going to be awesome. I have so many friends who are pregnant, and we're just going to go on coffee dates all day. So I definitely was like, I thought that as well, but
it sounds like you had a very realistic expectation. And I think that women who are surrounded by other women having babies they're always one step ahead, because you can see it unfolding before your eyes, and you can see, and even just, you know, they say watching someone else breastfeed is like the best way to learn. Like even just that is a big deal.
Yeah, my sister literally had her third child 3 months before Nora was born.
Oh,
and it
great.
Was
so like an apprentice.
Yeah, because my sister was even saying to me, she was like, you know, I know I've had two kids, but if I didn't have this one 3 months before Nora, I still would have forgotten all the newborn stuff. Whereas with this time round, it was so perfect. Because like, I remember seeing her in the hospital when she first had her baby, and she was just showing me exactly how she was breastfeeding. And then like when Nora was born, every tiny little thing, I'd just call my sister and she'd be like, oh yeah, Rosie just went through that a month ago. And, you know, it was like, I felt so lucky. It's like I had my own personal, I don't know, baby whisperer helper. It was
amazing. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I understood right. that I was very lucky and that not everyone gets that, you know, that experience, but it definitely made it easier for me.
And how was your first pregnancy and birth? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I often say I actually really loved pregnancy. And I know a lot of people don't. But when I would say that, people would say to me, oh, so you didn't get sick? And I was like, oh no, I got really sick in the first trimester, but I've just totally forgotten about it. So I guess, even though I did love pregnancy as a whole, that first trimester is so horrible. I really don't know how to describe it. And after just going through it again, it's quite fresh in my mind. But I think just that inability to eat what you want to eat, and the guilt and the sickness and the tiredness. So I definitely went through that, but no worse than anyone else, probably not as bad as some. Going back a little bit, I guess for us, we were so excited when we fell pregnant, because we had a little bit of trouble conceiving Nora. I never really got a regular period ever in my whole life. After talking to some friends, I went off the pill kind of 2 years before we wanted to have a child. And I ended up seeing a fertility specialist, because I literally, I think 1 year I got one period, and it was just impossible to know when that was coming. It was really helpful to kind of get some support before we were really stressed about conceiving, I think.
And what did they say was going on? Was it a hormone?
Yeah, it's funny. I did a lot of gym, quite intense gymnastics as a child. Mm-hmm. And they think that was probably the trigger. So, I didn't actually get a period until I was about 18.
Right.
And then it was never, ever regular. They thought there was a degree of PCOS as well, but it as you might probably are aware, PCOS is a spectrum, and I was quite low on that spectrum.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just, they just had no idea really. But I went on to a drug, I've forgotten the name of it. It's kind of similar to Clomid, kind of gives you that fake period. The first one failed, which obviously isn't nice at the time, but then I did another cycle of it. But in all honesty, I felt pregnant before that second cycle kind of started. So my doctor actually thinks that I actually might have just fallen pregnant from one of my random periods. So we'll never know. Yeah, that was kind of cool.
That would be amazing. I mean, that's, but anyway, it doesn't matter. You fell pregnant. It's great.
Exactly. So, I think, you know, lots of people have a bit of a story or a bit of a pathway until they actually fall pregnant. And as a whole, it wasn't too bad. I think it was about 6 months of that. But so we were obviously so excited, and then the morning sickness wasn't great, but the excitement was still there. And then I guess second trimester and everything, I absolutely loved it. I think some people look at me strangely when I say that I love pregnancy, but I just thought it was incredible what our bodies can do. I just found that, like, you know, Wollongong's a friendly place anyway, but I just felt like every random person just smiles at you, and you feel really special, I think, when you're pregnant. I don't know, do you feel like that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. The first trimester, no, and I was like, why am I doing this again, and why is this harder this time, and oh my god, it must be because I'm so old and you know, but now that I'm I'm really enjoying like having a real like bigger bump now and feeling so much. Like I feel him moving a lot and he has like regular awake times and he seems like when Margot talks to him, like he seems to respond to like all that stuff. I think is so exciting. I'm probably the first time around it was like pure excitement, and this time around it's excitement kind of tempered with what I know. I'm like, okay, like I am excited and I'm really happy about it and I'm feeling really positive, but also I know the reality of what's coming, so it's a little bit less like wee, you know.
Definitely. But even I don't know, I guess I just kind of felt like the pleasant things kind of outweighed the bad in this, in my first pregnancy especially. And I don't know, I had some friends who were struggling to fall pregnant at all. So I also just had this like, wow, I'm so lucky to be pregnant. Which I think we forget sometimes as well. But yeah, like still got the really bad back pain on and off in the third trimester. And I've never been a good sleeper. That was always difficult.
Pregnancy insomnia is not fun.
So bad, but yeah. Anyway, somehow you managed, and I think working full time and being pregnant, I found that really hard as well, to be honest.
Yeah, I think I can't even remember it feels like so, I mean, it was 4 years ago now, but I think I was working 4 days a week then, or one day from, anyway, can't remember. So did you do any preparation for the birth, and did you do any preparation for your postpartum?
Yes. So birth, yes. Both my mother and my sister have had emergency Caesars for their first and then planned Caesars for their other two children. Mm-hmm. So I was a little bit, even though I loved pregnancy, I had like an underlying anxiety the whole time that, the fact that no woman in my family basically had delivered a baby naturally. Mm. And my mum and my sister and I all carried our babies exactly the same. We carried really high. Neither of our babies' heads engaged ever. We stayed high until we were over 40 weeks. It was just like identical. And it wasn't until I got onto a midwife program at Wollongong Hospital quite late in my pregnancy. And then I got a fantastic midwife and I retold her the story, which my husband was getting sick of me telling everyone who basically was in sight of me. And she just straight away was like listened to me and was like, okay, that is quite significant considering that you're now like 39 and a half weeks and the head is nowhere near engaged. So she went straight away and they were basically just like, yeah, you're nowhere near engaged, that head is nowhere near engaging. So even though, going back, I guess, even with this history of my mum and my sister, I was still really keen for a natural birth, even though part of me thought it would never happen. But, I did everything in my power to be ready for a natural birth. So I went absolutely crazy reading books on, calm birth type stuff. I went to a calm birth course, active birth. I basically thought I had it in my head that that if I could just, I don't know, work with my hips and my pelvis, that I could have a birth naturally and everything. So I tried really hard to get myself in that frame of mind. Unfortunately it got to 40 weeks and the doctor just said, look, the head is so high up that I got put at a high risk because they were worried that if I went into a natural labor that the head would drop too quickly and it might clamp the cord.
Right.
Yeah. So they then wanted to induce me, so they basically booked me in the next day. I came into hospital and they wanted to induce me, but they were worried about an induction even because they said I'd have to have a doctor one person with their hand internally and one person on the outside to make sure they could guide that head down quite slowly.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, not very. but yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was interesting. And then they said, look, what we'll do is we'll try the gel first, the prostaglandin gel. And if nothing happens from the gel, we'll book you in for an elective Caesar tomorrow, type thing. And they, you know, as you might be aware, like the gel can kind of, it can kick off a pregnancy, I mean a labor, but otherwise it can just help kind of prepare your, prepare yourself. So I don't know, like the doctor had to insert the gel, because I was high risk, so the nurses weren't able to. Yeah. But they were basically like, nothing's going to happen. So, you know, wasn't I had like, we had books to read. We'd had, we had all these things that we thought we were going to do for this day that we're sitting in hospital. But within like maybe 30 seconds of that gel going in me, I was in serious pain.
And wow.
I was like, oh, it was weird. Not like pain. I don't know if pain's the right word. I was in extreme discomfort. That is exactly the word. And I was just sitting there and my husband was like, you don't look so good. Like my midwife was talking to me and she was like, okay, I'm going to go. I'll come back in a few hours. And my husband's going, no, you can't go. Like she doesn't look well. And I just said to my midwife, I said, I really need to go to the toilet. And she was like, hold on a moment. Did you need to go to the toilet, you know, before that gel went in? And I said, nope, but I need to go to the toilet now. And I was like, really need to go to the toilet. And she was like, oh, okay. And she, put her hand in and basically I think they had the monitors on and I had basically gone straight into a contraction.
Wow.
So what actually happened is I reacted to the prostaglandin gel. I had like an allergic reaction,
which is
rare. but yeah, so that was interesting. I had like alarm bells going off and a thousand doctors coming into the room. My husband passed out. And my midwife was incredible, like literally saved Nora's life. She started prepping me for surgery before the doctors even walked in the door, and Nora was delivered by emergency C-section 32 minutes after that gel went in.
Holy shit. Wow.
Not what we were expecting.
No.
But yeah, it was, I guess it was a while, like I can, it's probably easier to talk about now because it was 2 years ago, but it was just the weirdest experience ever. I felt lucky that I was still able to be awake in the surgery because at one point they thought they'd have to put me under a general. But yeah, Nora came out fine. So her heart rate completely dropped, which is hence why they got into surgery straight away. But she was absolutely fine when she came out. So even though, I really felt lucky, even though it was kind of weird, but.
Bit of a shock though, I would imagine. Like that's not to go from, hey, we've got, you know, however long, and then boom, half an hour later, here's a baby. That's full on.
We had like the TENS machine and everything. We had our playlist and our fairy lights, and it was quite funny looking back in a way. We were just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we didn't get to use any of that.
So coming out of recovery, were you able to initiate breastfeeding okay? Was that all?
Yeah. Although like they were really good. After they pulled her out, they did wrap her in a blanket, but then put her on my chest. And then they had to obviously stitch me up. So my midwife and my husband took Nora, and then they were allowed to come into recovery with me, which doesn't happen all the time. So that was really cool. And then I got proper skin on skin in recovery. It was amazing. I'll never forget Nora like literally lifted her head searching for my breast and like latched on straight up, and I just thought it was the most incredible thing in the world. That initial time afterwards was it was still really, 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 really good. I just had a really supportive team around me, and I wasn't able to get out of bed for ages, like not till the next day actually after after the Caesar, but it was still incredible. I felt really, really just instantly in love, and it was amazing.
We didn't get to whether you had prepared anything for postpartum. So tell me a little bit about bringing her home. Had you prepared anything?
I feel really silly saying this, but I actually didn't. Like,
it's not silly because I feel like that's basically every first time mum ever.
It's just so weird how much, like, there's so much that you can be told, and I just can't believe how much I read about the birth and just didn't really think about when the baby arrived. And it wasn't until we brought her home and I was suddenly like, oh my gosh, what do I do now? That people started like giving me some books on, you know, baby development and stuff like that. And I went absolutely crazy reading books in the first few weeks whenever I wasn't asleep or feeding. But I found that a lot of them were really structured. Like, this was more stuff around like sleep and routines and things like that. And I took what I wanted, but but also in the lead up, I guess, you know, I had imagined that I was going to like do all this cooking at the end of my pregnancy. But in reality, I did do lots of cooking, but I kind of like, in my normal life, I quite often just like constantly fill my freezer with food anyway. So I didn't really feel like there was much to do in that sense, because I never really cooked.
No specific foods, no.
Yeah. No. I guess I just knew that I wanted to eat like really nutrient dense whole foods in my pregnancy, and I wanted to do the same in my postpartum period. So it was, not a lot changed. I kind of always cook for 4 to 6 people. And we always eat dinner and then we freeze the rest. So I kind of already had a lot in the freezer. Awesome.
I actually think that's the best. People often will do like a full day of batch cooking, and that's great. But I think sometimes it's easier just to be doing your normal, meals, as long as it's kind of reasonably easily digestible stuff. But just freezing, if you make a big batch of soup, like freeze half of it. Yeah. Or like I'm like, okay, I know I've got some mince in the freezer that I've kind of earmarked to do a big bolognese, and half of that will get frozen. Like, it's just while you're doing your normal stuff, just double it.
Yeah. And I think maybe one thing I did differently was, instead of freezing everything in portions of two, I did do a few like single portion freezers. That was the main difference, I think. I always like batch cook grains as well. Mm-hmm. And I freeze them. So,
okay. Tell me a bit about that, because that is something that I cannot get my head around actually doing. So is it like rice, or what are you making?
Yeah, like rice, quinoa, barley, frika, whatever grain I'm cooking.
You cook it fully?
Yeah. I might slightly undercook it depending on the grain. But I will cook like 2 or 3 times the amount that I actually need for that meal. And then I measure out 1 cup portions and I chuck it in the freezer. So
specific, because I'm like,
no, that's fine.
So like you put in like a Ziploc bag or a jar or something, and then
whatever I have really. I've never specifically bought special containers for it, but if I have some random takeaway containers or jars, like we have a lot of jars, whatever I've kind of got, I freeze it. So my freezer is very full all the time.
It sounds like my freezer, really, and I'm like, dream of having a chest freezer.
I think some people are funny about reheating some grains, but I've never had a problem with it. I always reheat until they're like steaming, and then let it cool down. It just makes for a really, really quick, nutritious meal.
Okay, cool. All right, great. Yeah. I'm glad we've nailed that now.
Literally any grain, even chickpeas, lentils, everything. Freeze.
Really?
Yeah. I'm a big, big, big fan of freezing.
Okay, I am going to batch cook some great, because I love all of that stuff, but and I will batch cook it, but I'll then just batch it for the week. I've never
I never really, for some reason I don't do that. I might keep enough for the next day, but I freeze it all. I take it to work like that, add a tin of tuna and some ricotta and some veggies. I forgot what we were talking about.
Bringing Nora home. So what was it like bringing her home? You mentioned you got given books and there were some routines, and but that was not really what
I guess I followed them to some extent. Really didn't know what the heck I was doing. It was kind of nice to know ish, like about how much kind of sleep I was trying to aim for and how much ish awake time I was meant to have. I don't know, it feels like so long ago now, but I found some of them helpful, but I just think we just had to kind of work it into how Woz and I like to live our life. I was really lucky. Woz, he's a school teacher, a primary school teacher, and because of the Caesar, he was able to take 6 weeks off.
Amazing.
Which is kind of like carer's leave, I guess. Yeah. Because obviously, you're not meant to drive and do all that kind of stuff. So he was home for 6 weeks, which really made that immediate postpartum period so much easier. Like, I almost cry when I hear that some husbands only have a week off. I don't know how women do it. I remember getting to 2 weeks and thinking, if you went back tomorrow, I would not survive.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like that's one of the biggest things that people can do is if it's at all possible, if you can save for it or like build up annual leave, like get your partner if you have one, or you know, someone who lives with you to take a month off, at least a month.
Yeah, he was always planning on a month, and then with the Caesar it became 6 weeks. And at one point I thought, oh my God, am I going to get sick of you being here for 6 weeks? But I didn't in the slightest. Like, we kind of just got into this really beautiful pattern of kind of like, wouldn't really get out of bed till about 11 a.m. In saying that, I didn't get out of bed. Woz would like make me breakfast in bed and washing on and hanging out. And I, you know, but we would just kind of snuggle Nora and on and off feed her. And like, literally, I found it hard to get out of bed before 11. And then we'd often go to like just like a casual little cafe, and because Nora still slept so much, you know, she'd just be in the carrier and sleep, and we'd have coffee and do the crossword, and it was like this really magical 6 weeks. We had a lot of visitors, but I guess some people might not like having a lot of visitors, but we're really social and love our friends and family, so it was really, really nice. We had so much support. Even though the sleep deprivation was pretty crazy, the adrenaline was also very strong. It's crazy how much sometimes I didn't feel tired and I was like, I've had 2.5 hours sleep. How am I not like dying?
And it's like when you've got the opportunity to go to sleep, often you're just so wired.
Yes.
You kind of can't. It's really it's really hard. I always tell people if they can, you know, even if they can't sleep, because that was something I see it all the time, it's like try and do like a yoga nidra, which is like that really deep restorative relaxation, and allegedly, I don't know if it's true, but it produces the same type of brain waves as when you're asleep, so it's not as good as sleeping, but it's almost there. So if you can't sleep, and you might fall asleep anyway. But, it's hard, adrenaline.
Yeah, it was just – I just remember it so strong at the beginning. Obviously, there's challenges. I remember just describing it mostly as just being so constant. Like, I just couldn't believe how – like, you just – you're on 24/7, which was a hard – yeah, like there's no lunch break or – like finish time. And it sounds weird looking back, but I just remember sometimes like literally not being able to move, and I was like, oh, how am I meant to eat or go to the toilet or you know, things like that. Yeah. I got mastitis when she was 10 days old and ended up back in the hospital, which was kind
of crazy.
It was only one night. I had to go on some IV antibiotics. To be honest, I was more devastated that Nora had to spend a night in hospital, because I was like, oh no, the hospital's full of bugs, like I don't want you anywhere near the hospital. But got over that pretty quickly. And what else? She was like, I'm a very paranoid sleeper, so that was a struggle, but the adrenaline helped. She was a bit refluxy, but nothing too bad.
And feeding was like, other than the mastitis, you
feeding? Yeah, I remember feeling really bad when I went to my first mother's group, because people were really struggling with breastfeeding, and I couldn't believe how easy I had it. Like, Nora latched from the second she was born. She breastfed within 20 minutes from day one of being alive. Mm. And I didn't know what it was like to have difficulties with breastfeeding. I remember thinking, oh my God, I can't tell these women that I've done it, really, that it's not a problem. Like, I honestly kept quiet, or I'd almost just kind of agree with them or something, because I felt so bad. But then when Nora was 9 weeks old, she started refusing to breastfeed.
And oh, really?
Yeah, very odd. Even though it was a completely different issue to what a lot of people have, it was the most stressful thing ever. And then I was like, okay, I totally understand how stressful it is when you can't breastfeed, no matter what the reason is. It was so stressful. That actually lasted until 16 months when I gave up breastfeeding. So
tell me a bit more about that. What was?
So I think I had heaps of milk, and I think for the first 2 months of her life, I kind of got this instant letdown. So she didn't have to work for it at all. It was like she got on the boob, instant letdown, and her tummy was full literally in 10, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, I had so much milk that I could never feed her both sides. I tried once because other people did it, and I was like, oh my God, am I doing something wrong? Should I be doing both sides? So I tried both sides, and she projectile vomited so much, because it was just too much milk. Like, she just...
Yeah.
Anyway, so I learned that, and I think what happened is that at around that 8 week mark was when my boob started to settle. You know how you kind of get that? Yeah. And suddenly she had to work for that letdown. Might have been like 20, 30 seconds, but she just wasn't keen. She's a very independent, obviously impatient child. and so she would latch. Within 5 seconds, come off screaming, and I'd be like, oh my God, just stay on for a bit longer. So
telling you off.
Yeah, it was so weird. And what I ended up having to do was get a pump, and I would pump until I got the letdown, and then I would rip the pump off and put her on.
Oh, wow.
So that worked off and on. But it meant that I couldn't breastfeed in public, because she would just scream and scream and scream. And I needed my pump, and I needed to plug it in, because I didn't have one that was handheld. So, and you know how noisy a pump is. You're not going to sit there at a cafe while it's like pumping you. So, as a whole, breastfeeding ended up being our biggest challenge in her whole first year of life, even though she could technically do it so well. I had to like breastfeed her in the dark, and like Woz couldn't be anywhere near us. It was painful. But I guess you just put up with it. Like I got used to having to take the pump with me everywhere, and I got used to only leaving the house for a certain amount of hours so I could get home to breastfeed.
Mm. Did you bottle feed her at all?
If she was having a really bad day, I would have to express fully my whole breast, and then I would give her a bottle of my breast milk. So
and she would be okay with that.
She would take the bottle, sometimes more preferably. I was quite
I guess again, you don't have to work for the letdown on the bottle. That's why sometimes can be
I don't know, it was a lactation consultant or someone I spoke to said maybe put a different teat on so she has to work harder for the bottle. But at the same time, I was so grateful that she took the bottle, because that would have been
absolutely enough. Whatever works, right?
Yeah.
So, how tricky.
yeah, just one of those things you just don't expect. And it was just so funny because I was just, you know, I found the breastfeeding so easy, and then I suddenly had this whole different type of challenge. And
yeah,
but anyway,
it's funny. It's so individual, isn't it? It's like,
yeah. My friends' babies all loved the boob. Like, they were obsessed with the boob. And Nora would, like, even by the time I got her on and she fed, she'd be on there for 5 minutes, and then she would just, like, pull off and, like, almost, like, hit it away as if it was, like, offending her. And I'd just be like, oh, my God, this is so sad, because, like, I loved the breastfeeding and she didn't. And I was like, this is so, like, weird. Why am I so different to my friends' babies?
Oh, funny. And how was your physical recovery from the C-section and just in general?
Yeah, pretty good, actually. I was quite lucky with my recovery, I think. I have some, my sister's a physio, and I've got some other good friends who are physios, and they helped. I got some of those tights that are...
Oh, yeah, the compression.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I felt like they helped, like they made me feel like I was in, everything was in. I mean, it's funny. And to be completely honest with you, the scar and everything still feels very funny. Like a bit pins and needly, and I don't love it, to be honest. But in terms of like the recovery straight afterwards, like I was walking okay not too long afterwards, and did have some back pain, but it wasn't too bad. And I luckily had no pelvic floor issues, which I put down to the fact that it wasn't a natural birth. But yeah, so I felt quite lucky that I didn't have that. So. Yeah, there's always pros and cons to every birth method.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about how you used your dietitian hat to nourish yourself a bit after you had Nora.
Yeah. First of all, I just remember thinking I was just so bloody hungry 24/7. I'm a good eater on a normal day. And I just remember thinking, oh, my gosh, I can't think of anything but food because I'm so hungry. And I guess I just found that when I ate really nourishing foods, they just made me feel really good, gave me a lot of energy. So even though I personally love cooking, I had so much going in that immediate postpartum period that I didn't really do much. My husband did most of the cooking. We did a lot of just defrosting. I guess I just really opted for those really nutrient dense foods, making sure that I always had a decent amount of protein and fat and carbohydrates in my meals, just to give me a bit of sustenance. As we spoke about before, I guess I always have grains in the freezer, so I just grab things out. It was a very, I feel like I'm a lazy cook sometimes because I literally just grab things out of the freezer and put them together and grab a few fresh fruit and veg and it's kind of done, or a tin of tuna or sardines or something like that. I guess I kind of ate normally for me, but
A bit more than normal.
A lot more than normal. I'm very obsessed with porridge. I literally went to bed thinking about my porridge.
Really? Okay, yeah. So what do you like to put on your porridge? And are you a water person or are you a milk? Like, when
would you cook? Milk person, quite. I sometimes do half-half, actually. But I like to put I always add chia seeds just to give me, you know, those extra nutrients there. I went through this stage and I really love it, actually. It sounds weird, but a friend got me onto it, putting ginger, like fresh ginger, in my porridge.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Anything ginger.
Oh my gosh, so do I. So, like, literally chia seeds, ginger and dates. I could have eaten it 24/7.
Oh my God. I'm totally adding that to my postpartum list. I can't eat porridge at the moment because it spikes my blood sugars. And I also find porridge in general gives me indigestion unless I've soaked it from the night before. But I love it, and it's such a good warming food, and oats are good for supporting your milk supply as well. So it's a great postpartum food.
Because I've always liked porridge, but like my love for it just absolutely accelerated. In the morning, it was the first thing Woz would cook and like cook me. And he hates porridge. It's hilarious. He doesn't hate many foods. But, so he'd make it for me, and I, like, my serving size was huge. It looked like I was feeding a family. But I just absolutely, like, ate all of it. I loved it.
Amazing. I'm totally getting cravings for porridge now. I'm like, okay, I'm like thinking of all the things I can. I'm like, porridge with like ghee and some dates. Yes, this is what I'm going to
do. Yeah, it was just really weird. And the ginger just added this.
I don't know. Yum.
Absolutely loved it. Anyway, I should probably stop talking about porridge.
I'll just call this one the porridge episode. Okay, so tell me a little bit about this time around. Are you going to do anything differently for your postpartum, or prepare different foods, or?
A little bit, I would say. I think already in my pregnancy, I've done a few things differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because I've always had this interest in maternal nutrition and postpartum. And I thought that I would get more into it in my first pregnancy, but I was so busy working full time that I didn't. So after having Nora, I did so much research on it. The main things that I've changed in the pregnancy that I will also probably change my first trimester is also just like taking off that pressure of what we should, how do I explain it? Like, it's often felt in that first trimester where you don't really feel like eating these fruits and vegetables or whatever. But like this time round in my first trimester, I really took the pressure off what I should be eating and more what my body needed. I just feel like I've gotten much better at doing that. And I always, like, I naturally eat a lot of nutrient dense foods, but if I really just felt like a ham and cheese croissant followed by a toasted cheese sandwich, then it's kind of just what I had. And I think, like, you know, similar in the postpartum, like, oh, I love my nutrient dense foods and everything, but I still, you know, I enjoy all food. So just kind of like being a bit more of an intuitive eater, I think. In that way. I think also, like, this time round, I've learnt a lot more about, say, fermented foods and like eating things like liver and things like that, which I had never really known as much about in the past. So I'm very pro those foods. So I'm already eating them a lot more in my pregnancy, and I will really get into them more.
Are you doing liver? I'm doing liver. I'm doing pate in my pregnancy.
Yeah.
People look at you. I feel like that's such a real taboo because you said, that's one of the things that you're not supposed to eat. And yet in other countries, pregnant women are encouraged to eat shit tons of liver.
They're saved those organ meats because that they're for the pregnant women because they're the most, you know, they've got all the essential nutrients. And
yep.
Oh, I'm very passionate about it. I just feel like there's a big gap in knowledge. Hence my project on working with maternal women. But
yeah,
there's just so much that I didn't know in my first pregnancy and postpartum that I now know. And I promote it so much. Like, my friends can't shut me up about it. I don't know. Liver is just one of those foods that it's unfortunately, as you said before, it's tabooed in pregnancy. If you look up Australian guidelines, it'll say don't eat it, which is very hard to convince someone to go against that.
Of course, because, you know, people are, oh, it must be there for, and, you know, there is a small chance of food contamination, but there's actually more of a chance that you'll get listeria or some kind of food contamination from eating lettuce, and yet lettuce is not on the list. I remember reading Lily Nichols' book first around this, and I was like, oh my God, I could have been having pate the whole time. This pregnancy, I have been having, I can't say I've been having a lot of pate because I don't particularly like feel like having a lot of it, but I try to have it, you know, maybe once a week or something. And yeah. I do my bolognese with my sort of local organic butcher does beef mince with heart through it, which I think about too much makes me want to vomit, but I just don't think about it. And that's what the whole family gets, that the bolognese made with that, and bone broth in it as well. And that's that. And I'm eating, like, I've had sashimi. As long as I kind of trust the place that I'm getting it from, I'm like, I mean, I wouldn't get it from like the servo, but.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Gosh, the raw fish thing is like, I have researched that so much. In fact, when I came across Lily Nichols, I was like, oh my God, there's someone else who speaks my language. This is amazing. Raw fish as well. Like, you know, I could talk about the stuff all day, but the interesting thing about it is, you know, the selenium content, how it blocks the mercury and it's higher in DHA when it's raw and all these things. And I think the whole that whole being scared to eat certain foods, I think it's just done in completely the wrong way. I think rather than pinpointing certain foods and putting them in a no category, we should just be educating women on, you know, food hygiene and storage practices and where you buy it from.
Yep.
Because any food can be unsafe.
Exactly. Really.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, even the soft cheeses thing, it's like, I don't really eat much soft cheese anyway, but yeah, the whole thing around that, it's like, but all cheeses in Australia are pasteurized. So it's not even a thing. It's not, anyway, it makes me... dietary guidelines around pregnancy, don't get me started on gestational diabetes dietary guidelines, which are like they're from 1982. Literally. It's ridiculous. Anyway, we will not make this an episode about just ranting about dietary guidelines, but it makes me crazy.
It's just a funny thing because, like, with dietary guidelines, it just takes, like, you can understand why it is the way it is. It just takes so long for to hit there, and a public policy is so hard to make changes to. So I don't know how it will improve, but anyway, I just think that being informed and educated is the best we can do right now.
Absolutely. And I think it's also about professionals like you know, my endocrinologist, I've talked to her about the, you know, the differences in the gestational diabetes sort of standard diet that's given to you versus what I was, the Lily Nichols protocol. And she was like, oh yeah, the dietary guidelines are way, you know, the way old fashioned. You should definitely, so it's sort of being, having those health professionals who are really on it and up to date with the latest research rather than just relying on that same old guidelines, which are not up to date. Yeah. Anyway. So tell us a little bit about the projects that you're working on now. And how people can work with you if they want to, and where people can find you.
Yeah, cool. So I started writing a book, actually, when Nora was a few months old. She wasn't a bad day sleeper, and I kind of thought, okay, I'm ready to do something. And I've been wanting to write a book on pregnancy nutrition since I started my prac 7 years earlier. So it was a long-term passion of mine. And I'd been kind of like keeping little notes on it over the years. But anyway, I finally felt like I was in the headspace to do it. So I called one of my best friends who is a journalist, was a journalist, sorry. Now she's a high school English teacher, and her sister is a dietitian. So, I called her and I said, do you remember that book that I wanted to write? And she was like, yes, I remember this. And I said, okay, you're doing it with me. and she was like, oh yeah, I'll help you write it. And I was like, no, this is we're doing this together. You know, we both got different skill sets, and we'll, I think it will make a really great pair. And I said, have a think about it. And she was like, yeah, nah, keen, give me a project, done. So it was, that was that. So we've now been working on this book for 18 months. It's challenging because she works full time and lives in Margaret River in WA.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I've obviously had a baby, so I could only work on it when Nora slept. So it's been a slow process, but it's basically a book helping to educate and empower pregnant women with new updated research on pregnancy nutrition. And it's a cookbook as well. So going back to my love of food and cooking, I've kind of also been, would have loved to have written a cookbook one day. And I feel like it was just a perfect combination of the two. I just felt really sad when I was pregnant that I had a lot of friends who were so anxious about eating in their pregnancy. Mm. And I just thought this should not be something that you should be worrying about. I'll never forget a friend told me she went on a hen's party and the only thing she ate all day was like red frogs and snakes because she didn't know if she could eat anything because she said there was like spinach and cheese triangles. And she was like, oh, I think it was spinach and ricotta triangles. She was like, I think I can't eat ricotta, even though it was cooked.
Yeah.
And there was all these things. And I just remember thinking, that's so sad that that in our culture at the moment, it's more about, I don't know, it's more about food restriction rather than eating food. Like if you said to someone, what do you know about pregnancy nutrition when they fall pregnant? They'd say, oh, I can't eat this and this and this. They wouldn't say, I need to eat this, this, and this, and this. So I was very, very passionate about, rather than restricting food, we need to be liberalizing it. And there was just this big gap of what the newest research was saying compared to what our current guidelines were saying. I just thought that everything was very fear-based. Mm. Rather than empowering, and I wanted to empower women. You know, we're intelligent creatures, and I think we can make a lot of decisions for ourselves if we're informed and if we have access to the right information. Mm. So that's kind of where the passion from the book came from. Little did I know that you don't just decide that you want to write a book and give it to a publisher and they publish it for you. So I didn't really realize that there's a lot to go through, and even though we did submit to a lot of publishers, traditional publishers, we weren't successful, which looking back is pretty obvious. So I didn't realize that we actually really had to have a social media presence and do all these other things to help with a publish a book. Surprisingly, in this day and age, I'm actually not very much of a social media person. So about a year ago, we started our social media account called Nurture the Seed. And it was difficult for me at first because I didn't even know what a story was. I didn't even know what a hashtag was. So I've come a very long way. And I didn't realize how good it would be, how helpful it's been, learning off other people, finding people on there like yourself who, you know, you realize that, you know, you're trying to share some very similar values and messages. And we've had a lot of feedback from people saying that it's really helped them with little things and some of the recipes that we post and things. So our Instagram is kind of like what we're using in the meantime to help educate women, and we'll keep using it, obviously. And fingers crossed sometime next year we'll be able to release the book.
How exciting. That's such a big achievement. I've sort of in the back of my mind, I'm like, I'd love to have a book one day. And yeah, it's a big undertaking. So I take my hat off to you.
It is. And I think it's very different when, I've found out along the way that other people who have written books, a lot of them are kind of like approached by a publisher. It's, you know, they have a very big social media presence or influence. Yeah. And that's kind of how it's so different. And I had no idea, like being a clinical dietitian, you have no idea. Like we don't use social media in my job at all. I just had no idea. Like, you know, my husband doesn't even have any sort of social media. We're a little bit kind of behind. Maybe we should have been alive in the 1960s or something, but it's so foreign to me. It is, you know, it's not until now that I've realized it is a really great way to communicate to people and to help people. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, we just thought it's a really good place to start educating women, and yeah, I don't know.
And, yeah, it's well worth a follow. I've bookmarked several of your little recipes that you've put up there. They're always fantastic. So that's at Nurture the Seed, right?
Yes, correct.
Yep, cool. Was there any other things you wanted to mention?
No.
I did want to ask you, based on all of that stuff that you're writing about, what would you say are like the top three foods you would love to see every pregnant woman eating?
Liver would be my number one. I'm actually working on a project at the hospital with one of the midwives. We're putting together an information booklet on iron in pregnancy, mm-hmm. because what's happening is they're getting a lot of women being either admitted or coming into hospital because their iron is so low and they're needing transfusions. And she was like, look, there's got to be a better way to be doing this. Mm-hmm. So I was very keen to jump on the project with her. And when I first said to her, like, I really, really want to appetize liver, she was like, people aren't going to eat it. I said, well, they're not if we don't start recommending it. And I had found that the Royal Women's Hospital for Women, Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne, they talk about it. And I was like,
oh,
yes,
that's good.
Yeah, they have an iron leaflet and it talks about eating liver. And I think I said, look, I think we've just got to start. If we've got to start somewhere and we've got to start getting the word out, I said, because it is the cheapest way to get your iron up and the most effective way. Like the iron in liver is so well absorbed by our body, not to mention all the other nutrients that liver has, mind you, but you don't need much to get so much benefit. So, yeah. And I understand that not everyone likes the taste of liver. I don't particularly love it on its own, but as you said before, put it into things like spag bol and
I would never eat, like, my dad loves to eat like livers with onion over rice. I'm like, that's disgusting. Well, I know some people like that's not my thing, but put it in pate with beautiful spices and heaps of ghee and it's beautiful, and you have it with a bit of sauerkraut on toast. Oh my God. It's like that and bone broth is those would also be for postpartum the number one things, because in postpartum as well, iron is the most common deficiency. So yeah, bring on the pate.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. And anyway, so I would love to see more women eating liver, but I think they just need to be educated on the fact that, yes, that does have vitamin A in it, but you're not going to eat enough for that to be an issue. So if you just have it once a week, like what you said, it's going to give you you're going to get a really high dose of iron, and your chances of needing iron supplements is going to be much lower, because no one likes to take iron supplements. A lot of the time they block you up and, you know, you get very constipated on them. That was a long-winded answer to that, but
no, I love it. That's like my favorite answer.
What other food? I would just say more whole foods in general is probably a very boring answer to that question, but I did feel like when I was pregnant the first time, people kind of put me in this category of oh, you're pregnant now, you won't be able to be bothered to cook anything. You'll probably just get a lot of takeaway and things. And I thought, my first trimester, maybe that's how I felt. But I still wanted to be empowered to cook delicious foods when I was feeling better. Which not everyone's lucky enough to feel that way. But, I think just really focusing on whole foods and getting a nice range of fruits and vegetables and, you know, legumes. Actually, that would be my third answer. Legumes. More legumes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Renee, and sharing all your wisdom and your experiences. It's been great to chat.
Yeah. No, it's been really lovely. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Tales from the Fourth Trimester. I appreciate each and every one of you who listens, shares, rates and reviews and does all of those things, tells a friend, the works. If you'd like to connect with me, you can head on over to Instagram or Facebook at Cocoon by Naomi is where you can find me. You can head to my website, which is www.cocoonbynaomi.com. Thanks and see you next week.